Welcome, everyone, to the Australian Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Justin, your host, and today I'm joined by Dale from thebitcoinshepherd.com to discuss some recent global and local Bitcoin news. But before we start, a quick word from our sponsor. The Australian Bitcoin Podcast is brought to you by hardblock.com.au, Australia's first and oldest Bitcoin-only exchange. Hardblock aims to help their users save in hard money and to become self-sovereign Bitcoiners. Hardblock has no added fees on deposit, buy, or sell transactions, so the prices are what you see are what you get. Hardblock's Bitcoin withdrawal fees are also among the cheapest in Australia, including a very low 99 sat Bitcoin withdrawal cost when using their new auto send feature. Check out Hardblock today. All right, Dale, how's it going?
Doing very well, thanks. How are you, man?
Yeah, can't complain. A lot of big news at the moment, it seems like.
Absolutely. And
just to give a bit of context for listeners, you'll be new on the podcast for this episode. However, you and I have done an interview about a week or two ago, which I had scheduled to come out in about a week or two. However, both Daniel and Jeremy are away this week, which is usually who I would do, say, a news podcast with. So you've been gracious enough to come on and share your time with us. But I would say to people who don't know about Dale to definitely check out that interview in a couple of weeks' time. But perhaps just for listeners, did you want to give a brief background about yourself and what you do with both BTC Shepherd and Crypto News? It doesn't have to be too much detail, knowing that we've got a couple of hours coming out soon, but just so they're aware.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, thanks very much for having me. And yeah, as I say, my name's Dale. I've got a company called The Bitcoin Shepherd. Initially started out as a sort of educational service for beginners, basically just live orange pilling noobs from the ground up, just sort of first principles of money, and then gradually walking through, pushing them down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, as it were, and then helping them on the path towards self-custody and all that sort of thing. Over time, I sort of started writing and offering editorial and content services, which is what I do through a company called Crypto News Australia. And so I'm an editor there, and I also write an article a day as much as I can about Bitcoin. Sometimes I write about some of the other coins. It keeps my sort of sharpens my tools, and I quite enjoy having a sense of the broader ecosystem. Really enjoyed the podcast we had. And I think if anyone's interested, my website's thebitcoinshepherd.com.
Definitely check it out and check out that interview in a couple of weeks as well to find out a bit more of a deep dive into Dale's history and thoughts about Bitcoin.
Awesome.
So we'll jump into the news. We'll start with global news. There was a pretty big announcement yesterday that came out around Central African Republic being the first country in Africa to adopt Bitcoin as a payment currency. So this has been verified in a couple of news outlets, but nothing really, really mainstream yet. So I still feel like this is very sudden news and too good to be true news. I guess sometimes good news is that way, but I'm very tentatively saying this seems legit. But at the same time, I'd say maybe let's wait another week or two and see if there's more official announcements, even from the actual government themselves. However, from everything that I've read, it does certainly sound like they've had law passed, not just drafted, but passed through their government that essentially makes Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies legal tender. It's able to be paid to merchants, is able to be paid to the government for taxes. So we'll see from there. Have you heard much about this one, Dale?
Yeah, I have. And obviously being, as you can hear, I'm South African, so I tend to treat news coming out of South Africa sometimes, or Africa generally, just with got to be a bit cautious because sometimes the sources there aren't necessarily the best. From my perspective, at this point, it looks like there's a lot of conflicting news. As you say, former Blockstream exec Samson Mao has sort of taken the lead on global Bitcoin adoption and or sort of nation state Bitcoin adoption, and sent out a tweet. I think it was a little earlier today, just sort of saying it wasn't quite what was reported, but I think you touched on a number of key points. I think the government there is recognizing the fact that the current financial system is not effective in the sense that it's expensive and cumbersome to remit payments across the nation. They're basically saying the current financial architecture is not really working. And so they want to embrace what they've called cryptocurrencies. I can't confirm at this juncture whether or not it's actually a law or if it's a bill to be passed. I suspect the latter, if I'm honest with you, but I think this is sort of a watch the space kind of thing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that mirrors what I've seen of it so far as well. The article that I saw originally was from Forbes Monaco, which makes me think strange that it's just the Forbes Monaco branch or subsidiary or whatever it's called, Fraction, that's releasing this rather than just an entire Forbes article. And also read something similar to you where they don't want it to be under the existing financial system, under the existing payment rails, because they see that as being very inefficient. But yeah, if Samson Mao has basically said to temper our expectations about this, that's pretty telling, because his lead up to the Bitcoin conference was saying that he's got, you know, three really big mic drop moments and it's going to blow everyone's mind. And he was, you know, teasing Honduras and Guatemala and Mexico and all these other places as nation state adoption. And it didn't end up being, well, it was good, but it wasn't anywhere near that level. So if he is coming out now to say, temper your expectations with this news, it doesn't sound as straightforward as, you know, as what that first article said. I think that's kind of telling, but still.
100%. I agree with you. I actually heard a podcast yesterday with Max Kaiser and he, at the conference, and apparently Honduras was on track to actually go ahead with it and implement Bitcoin as or adopt it as legal tender, and some suits arrived from the US, what they call economic hitmen, and caution them against it, and so it turned out to only be sort of a small semi-autonomous region that elected to, and it wasn't even adopted as legal tender per se. I think they just made it really it's sort of Bitcoin friendly in the sense that it was zero capital gains tax and that kind of thing.
That's right. I think that's Prospera, which is off off the coast of Honduras, but still part of Honduras. Yeah, that's interesting to hear, because I recall the IMF set up or gave a recent loan to Argentina. I think I'm getting that right. I'm pretty sure it's Argentina. And within that loan, the document itself, it had had some stipulations about saying, you know, you can't adopt a cryptocurrency. You need to have, you know, all these regulations and protections in place around cryptocurrency. And of course, it was all, you know, to protect the user, so to speak, to protect the investor. But at the same time, it sounded like we're going to give you a bunch of money, but don't use this to go buy cryptocurrencies or adopt cryptocurrencies. So I'm certainly not surprised that if Honduras was on track to implement it, that they received a knock on the door from some economic hitmen to say, look, we can maybe help you out financially, but it's under our rules.
Mm. Yeah, spot on. And you're right about Argentina. That was exactly the case, saying we'll give you some money, but it comes with a caveat. You got to tell your citizens not to be buying crypto, as they say. Yeah, so...
It's one of those things. It's very short-term thinking, isn't it? I'm sure for a country that might be in dire straits and need more liquidity, that is, it feels like a bit of a savior moment. But then at the same time, if it just locks you under that same servitude for the next 50 years or 100 years or forever, because none of those loans really get paid back anymore, it's not the best long-term approach. But I guess it depends on your election cycles and how quickly that comes around.
Spot on. It comes down to politics, I think. Yeah.
So next bit of news is Elon Musk's hostile takeover attempt of Twitter, which as of this morning, it sounds like Twitter has accepted his offer. But initially, there was some interesting parts, some details that came out of this, where when he'd initially put in his offer, I think it was around like $54 per share or something along those lines, which is up about maybe 25 to 30% from where the share price is at the moment. So would be considered probably a very good price for shareholders. The board initially was considering options to not accept his offer, and even at one point said they were going to take the poison pill approach, which essentially is issuing new shares, diluting current shareholder values so that a new shareholder could step in, not Elon Musk. He would be unallowed to buy those new shares. That they didn't go ahead with that, but around the same time, Vanguard stepped in and ended up buying additional shares for themselves and pushed them over what Elon Musk had. I think he had something close to a little bit over 9%, and then Vanguard stepped in and they ended up buying something over 10%. They didn't buy over 10%, but they bought enough to bring their current holdings over that amount. So since then, Elon Musk has, sounds like he's got maybe another couple of partners involved, and he's taken out additional loans and sort of backed it with Tesla stock as well as some of his own money, and has upped the offer, which they've now accepted. Other bit of detail that I found really interesting with this was that once Jack Dorsey decided to step away from the board, the rest of the board cumulatively held less than about 1%. I say less than 1%, but I think it was less than 0.5% of Twitter shares, which to me makes no sense from a financial incentive. How do you have a board of around 12 people that are meant to be looking out for shareholders and are meant to be incentivized to drive, you know, profit from what the business does, and none of them are actually benefiting from it? To me, that seems like political appointments Whether it's political with a capital P or political with a small p, it's just, you know, knowing the right people and that kind of thing. Either way, it sounds like it's now, you know, come to an end to some degree. We'll see what our new overlord of Twitter does with the whole space.
Yeah, I agree with most of what you said there, man. You know, I think so you bought it for $44 billion. It seems as if about half of it's being financed through debt, borrowed against his Tesla shares. And then he's got some equity partners, as you said. I understood it to be like a 38% premium on the shares that were trading on April 1st. So it's difficult for a board of directors acting in good faith to turn down something like that. But I think, I guess there's two comments that I would add that I think is relevant for kind of, I guess, listeners and I guess the broader crypto community, if you like. You know, the one is Twitter is effectively the town square of the crypto space, if you like. I mean, it's really not happening on Instagram and Facebook and these kind of places. And so in that sense, it's almost as if despite his sort of missteps with Bitcoin in the past, he's a far better custodian of the town square than, I guess, some of the woke capital in Silicon Valley. Let's just put it that way. The other side that I think is fascinating, and I'm not sure if you've come across this, is one of his key focuses is to get rid of the sort of spam bots and the crypto scam bots that are out there. And so what Saylor, or Michael Saylor from MicroStrategy, has proposed is an orange tick powered by the Lightning Network, where you basically post $20 worth of Satoshis, and then you get a nice orange tick next to your profile. And then if you are obviously guilty of spamming, as we all have seen in the comments section, you'd lose your collateral. And in that sense, it sort of forces the protocol to be more honest, because the user experience has been substantially undermined, in my estimation, over the last while through these sort of bots. I mean, I'll look at a comment when I'm looking for news and stuff, and there'll be like 10 comments, and the comments have nothing to do with the actual tweet. It's just like, here's a new shilling this project. And it's just like, you know, it's hard to have that sort of valuable conversation, if you like.
Absolutely. And it is completely rife. Like I've only had about 3 tweets that have had more than about 100 likes on them. So I would consider that some level of virality relative to me.
Yeah.
However, when I have a tweet like that, I end up getting these replies from spam bots. And I think this is not low hanging fruit. There's like very few people looking at my tweets. So if I'm getting spam bots on that, could you imagine someone like Michael Saylor or Elon Musk or anywhere in between, essentially, with more than 1,000 or 10,000 followers? You're just going to have, it's unusable at that point. Screws up your notifications. Anyone actually trying to engage genuinely just can't.
Totally. And also the blue check Twitter was very political, you know, in the sense that there were tons of folks out there who had a lot of valuable content, particularly in the Bitcoin space, but who were not verified. And then you get some random journalist for the New York Times who's got a blue check. And so one hopes that with Musk's acquisition, you can strip some of that political stuff away. And I think one of the things that he's going to be pushing is freedom of speech. And he says, look, even if I want my enemies to be here too, and my opponents. And I think that's how free speech works, you know?
Absolutely. He's been making a lot of really based comments in the last, well, few weeks, and he has for a long time, but sometimes he's a bit hit and miss with the things that he says and does. But certainly in the last couple of weeks, very pro free speech, anti-censorship, even realizing things like ESG are, you know, it's more or less a woke movement that's not achieving the outcome that it's intended to. Mm. So I think if anyone's going to be in control of Twitter, it seems like he might be our best bet at the moment and most capable and has the right kind of even guidance, because Michael Saylor seems to be replying to a lot of his tweets and seems to, even in his recent interview with Lex Fridman, kind of alluded to Twitter and something like that, something like this was going to happen. And that was before Elon Musk had made his announcement about it. I was sort of reading between the lines, so it wasn't really direct, but it makes me think that maybe they've had some sort of conversation in the past, even at the recent conference, because if we do see something like an orange tick feature, I would imagine that's, you know, that's been driven by Michael Saylor. And that's just a really cool model, the idea of like free from free. I'm not sure if you've seen Sphinx Chat, because they sort of introduced this idea that, you know, if you are signing up for a free service, it's not really free, you are the product. And on top of that, things like spam will be rife. So to be free from free, as in to put up a little bit of collateral every time you want to put your view out there, and as long as you're doing it genuinely, you'll be able to get that collateral back. But anyone who's not engaging genuinely will lose it. To me, that seems like a brilliant model. And if Twitter goes that route, yeah, I think that's great.
100%. And I actually, I suspect that there might be a little bit of a backdoor for Dorsey to come back. That's the funny thing now. I think he was sort of sidelined and you know, in his role, but I wouldn't be shocked if Elon brought him back when the company eventually goes private.
Yeah, because Jack Dorsey had made some comments towards the end of his tenure. Well, I don't know if tenure is the right word, but end of his sort of, you know, reign at Twitter, basically saying that most of it's now just driven by marketing. So what is going to get the marketing bucks? And that's what is driving features and decisions. The fact that Elon Musk wants to open source a lot of their algorithms to make it clearer why people are seeing certain things, and also to have some selection in which algorithm of data that gets presented to you, I think Jack Dorsey would be all over that. And it makes sense. I hadn't actually thought of Jack Dorsey coming back to Twitter, because I know there's this other thing called, I think it's Blue Sky, which is like the Twitter alternative that's free and open source. Like a merging of these two products now or something like that, because the downside of ever trying to set up a free and open source Twitter is that you don't have the same network effects. You might end up with like 10,000 people on Blue Sky or even a million, but it's not the same as Twitter, which has got hundreds more.
Totally.
Have to wait and see, but otherwise it seems like good news to me, especially when it comes to freedom and free speech.
Agreed.
So another bit of news here out of Sri Lanka. So the Sri Lankan Central Bank, and I guess you could say government by proxy, has defaulted on their foreign debt, which is $51 billion of external debt. So they've called this a last resort, as they're running out of their foreign exchanges and don't have the liquidity to purchase more to service those loans, as they're having a humanitarian crisis, especially in regards to housing and food shortages. So it makes complete sense that this would be the decision that they make. But this is, to me, like another nail in the coffin of government bonds and how they don't come with no risk, because that's always been the conception, is that if you own another government's debt, you know, they will come good on it in the fullness of time. Now we know that that's not actually the case. These defaults seem to be coming more frequent, which to me is, despite the situation that they're in from a humanitarian perspective, I think is just really educational for the rest of the world to look at and to determine where should I be putting my money for my next generation or the generation after that. Maybe government bonds are not going to be the best approach.
Totally. Yeah, there's a couple of interesting things that come out of that for me. Is the one is that part of the reason why they're in such economic strife is because tourism is a big component of what they do. And I think with the supply chain disruptions, as well as the sort of limitations on freedom and movement over the last couple of years, the economy has been decimated, you know, as is Bali and other places that rely so heavily on that sort of kind of economic activity. So it speaks to me about, like how a centralized approach, which was really directed from above by the World Health Organization and others, has sort of trickled down to have an effect on, I'm not sure how many people live in the country. I think it's something like just north of 20 million. And so, yeah, they sort of had no part to play in that decision, but other folks were making decisions effectively impacting their lives. The other interesting thing is with a lot of these third world nations, and I can speak to South Africa because I know that one quite well, is there's a difference between having sort of your local bonds in a local currency or sort of dollar denominated bonds debt. And that's the real problem. When countries have a lot of dollar denominated debt, when the dollars dry up, in other words, you're not trading for whatever reason, you don't have the exorbitant privilege of printing dollars. And so you can't help but default. And then the IMF comes and says, all right, don't worry, guys, we'll sort this out. Here are the rules of the game. South Africa has been very wise in very few respects, but this is one where the vast majority of their loans, all the debt is in rands. So they can print more rands. They're just going to inflate it away, whereas a really small component is dollar denominated. So I think if I was in a third world country, I'd be reducing my I would be having as few dollar denominated loans as possible, just knowing that you know, anything can happen in the future and you can't print the currency in question.
That's right. Yeah, I guess foreign debt's not really an issue when you can just export your inflation to print more to pay it.
Yeah.
But then, of course, the this is very similar to that first news story, or not even the first news story, what we kind of riffed off of, like Argentina, you know, once the IMF steps in to, you know, save Sri Lanka in quotations, that just locks in this happening again at some point in the near future, because I'm sure the IMF is not issuing loans. Well, they would be issuing loans essentially backed by US currency. Denominated in US currency, which just exacerbates this problem. It sort of kicks the can down the road, doesn't it?
Yeah, correct, man.
I had another point there, but it slipped my mind. But it often does that, so that's okay. I'm sure it'll pop back up at some point. it's come back. So there was a recent clip on YouTube floating around, on Twitter, which is also on YouTube, of one of the IMF directors more or less saying that they are not always considering the negative externalities that come from things like printing more money and saying, you know, we're out of time when it comes to the climate. And, you know, we had to do this because of COVID, but we have printed so much and now maybe we have too much money and not enough assets, not enough actual value. And she even gave this metaphor of like, we're like a bunch of kids chasing the soccer ball, where we're just focused on the soccer ball and we're not focused on all the other things that might be going on in the field. She was there with Christine Lagarde, Jerome Powell. Mm-hmm. And so these are the big wigs of, you know, of the central bankers. They are the central bankers, essentially. And for them to be saying this, like, maybe we're printing too much money, maybe we're too myopic on printing money to save the problems, and now it's causing all these issues, while at the same time stepping in to print more money and to give Sri Lanka more debt and Argentina more debt and everything else. But at least they're saying the quiet part out loud now, which is just a really interesting development.
Totally, totally. That same head of the IMF, or I'm not sure what her role is, but she also did call for Bretton Woods 3 moment probably like 12 months ago now, something like that. So it is a rare moment of self-reflection, but one wonders if it's sincere or what I like to call CYA, cover your ass. But I don't
exactly
know.
Right. And even, you know, what does Bretton Woods 3 look like in their version of the world? Because this could Bretton Woods 2 didn't work out so well. So it's, you know, we keep trying out similar sort of things, and whether we just call it by a different name, we all agree to kind of hit the reset to some degree and then keep going with what we're doing. Doesn't sound like the best approach, but it is very interesting that they're being more transparent about these things. That's definitely a shift in the narrative. And I guess what's called like the Overton window, it's now allowed to talk about,
yeah,
the big wigs making mistakes sometimes, the central banks doing things that are going to have negative externalities. So that in and of itself will get that on people's mind a lot more, which is I'm happy with.
Yeah, yeah, agreed.
So another somewhat related news, Janet Yellen, who's the US Treasury Secretary, gave a 30-minute speech about digital assets, including quite a bit about Bitcoin. And it was surprisingly well-informed about Bitcoin and surprisingly complimentary. Now, the entire speech was monotone, and it seems like it was probably written by someone else. So it's not like she had a lot of enthusiasm or like oomph to what she was saying. However, the fact that she explained a bit of the history around Bitcoin, the pseudonymous inventor, how it solves the double spend problem, how it looks like it could be doing, you know, efficient transactions that remove central intermediaries. These were all, in my mind, very well-informed takes. And then she talked about CBDCs and basically said, you know, the problem with Bitcoin is it's not fast enough, which to me says she doesn't know enough, because Lightning is certainly fast enough. But then she used that as a bit of a segue to say, well, you know, but for the currency, for the medium of exchange part, maybe that's where CBDCs come in. And to me, reading between the lines, it means that maybe Bitcoin will be the store of value and CBDCs would be the medium of exchange in the way that they view the world, perhaps. And maybe they're not just looking at Bitcoin being the store of value, but, you know, these sort of digital assets, this very large umbrella to say, well, you know, they can be a store of value for people, but perhaps the currency itself is still something issued by the central banks. So interesting news nonetheless. It still seems to be directionally heading the wrong way in terms of CBDCs, but the fact that, again, some of the quiet parts are being said out loud in a complimentary way about Bitcoin, and even maybe alluding to Bitcoin being a store of value, that's grossly different to, say, a year ago when that same person was saying they seem to be used for, you know, nefarious reasons, and you're going to lose all your money, maybe, if you invest in them, and, you know, buy, beware, etc. So this is a like a 180 shift in terms of at least what's being said about Bitcoin. So interesting news nonetheless.
Absolutely. I think it's fascinating. I mean, if anyone's interested, they should look up the video, and they just put it at 1.5 speed because she does talk slowly.
Definitely.
But I found it really fascinating. And, you know, it represents a complete 180, as you say. And I think what's quite interesting is by pushing it at Bitcoin as a store of value, and they've actually said it out loud, is that it's not good as a medium of exchange. It's almost as if, okay, we now are recognizing this thing. We can't ignore it anymore. Initially, it was so small, we just could ignore it. Then it's like used for criminals. Then it's destroying the environment. And slowly but surely, okay, it's here. Oh, it's okay. It's got value. And then, but it's still not good enough because it's not a good medium of exchange. And so they'll kind of ignore Lightning and they'll say, but here we go. We've got CBDCs. My read long-term would probably be that I don't think CBDCs are going to happen in the US. And if they do come, I think that there will be all these built-in privacy mechanisms. I just have a sense, and like I've spent sort of around 9 months living and working there in the US. I feel that I've got a good read on the kind of the ethos of freedom. And they very much, I think there would be an aggressive pushback towards anything like reflecting a Chinese style or CCP style, rather, digital one, where effectively, can track every single movement, switch it off and on at their will. So that sort of dystopic CBDC, I don't see happening in the US. But I guess also just for your listeners' benefit, there's a distinction between retail and wholesale CBDC. So the wholesale are between the central banks, and I think that makes all the sense in the world, and they can do whatever they want. But I think for us, we should be concerned about retail CBDCs particularly.
Absolutely. Yeah, it kind of removes all that potential competition, removes all that potential freedom, as well as privacy, really. Interestingly, I kind of agree with you in terms of while it seems like Bitcoin Twitter is very American-centric, and it seems like the whole push for CBDCs has been coming out of America this whole time. But as it's gotten closer and closer to that cusp, I do feel like there's a big pushback. And there was a really good episode from Bitcoin Magazine, FedWatch, which with, I can't remember his name. I think it's Ansel, but I can't remember his last name. Regardless, I'll tag him perhaps, because he was saying that the Fed might be something that is disbanded in the relatively near future. Now, what relatively means could be in the next couple of years, and that there has been a couple of bills already proposed by, I think, on both sides of their political party system to essentially say, we don't want CBDCs and we don't even want the central banks involved in this anymore. Now, unfortunately, what his theory was, or maybe his interpretation of other people's theories, was essentially that it might mean that the state says we should be the ones issuing it. So we don't need a central bank anymore. We can just have a state-issued digital currency. And we'll make sure it's more free and less surveillance and everything else. So, you know, we might be swapping one bad for another bad, but I kind of agree with you that maybe it's not as straightforward as that. We're just barreling ahead to a CBDC one way or the other.
Yeah.
Very interestingly, Senator Bragg is doing a Ask Me Anything, I would say at the moment, but I think it sort of ended an hour or so ago, about what his cryptocurrency regulatory framework and roadmap might look like in Australia. I say his, but I think it's a bit broader than him, but his seems to be intrinsically involved. And someone asked, you know, will we have a CBDC similar to the digital yuan? And he said, if we have something like an Australian sovereign digital currency, we are not going to be basing it off of China's model, that's for sure. We'll need to make sure that there are better requirements around privacy and issuance. And he was very kind of, you know, just brief about that. But at the same time, that sounds like we are not supportive of that. We'd be looking at something different. Again, we don't know what that different means. But all this, yeah, it seemed like we were barreling ahead with CBDCs, and now everything's sort of like just pulling back at this last moment to say, like, hold on, maybe we need to rethink this, or maybe it's not going to be the way that everyone's been saying for such a long time.
I agree, yeah.
I guess one final point there, you were mentioning that they've now, like Janet Yellen's comments, she's now noticed that Bitcoin could be a store of value, but they're disregarding the medium of exchange. You know, that's kind of very commensurate with what usually happens, isn't it? You know, we go from like a collectible to a store of value, mm-hmm. to a medium of exchange, then a unit of account. Like that is the trajectory, evolutionary kind of trajectory of money. And although most, like you and I and other people listening to this, would be at the point of saying, like, it's not just a collectible or just a store of value, it's now also a medium of exchange. It's kind of all three of those things. And for some people, it's becoming a unit of account. I think it's going to take a while. I don't know how long a while is for everyone else to kind of catch up, especially if they have alternative incentives to be pushing their own currency. So the fact that they're now at the store of value point, I think that's pretty bullish. And I think in the matter of time, it'll be at the unit of exchange or medium of exchange point as well, once they maybe learn a bit more about Lightning or have a CBDC sort of push back onto the the cutting room floor, so to speak. See what happens from there. But yeah, interesting, like reading between the lines on a lot of this stuff all kind of happening at the same time and shaping up a bit differently to even what I expected, say, if we go back 6 or 12 months. So it's cool to be proven wrong, at least, vaguely at the moment.
In a good way.
Exactly right, yeah.
Yeah. I think I tend to describe where we are with Bitcoin as a speculative store value. It's speculative in the sense that it hasn't been widely recognized as such. And so I always sort of draw the comparison with gold and say, look, you know, it's recognized as a store of value, therefore its volatility is very low. The only thing what doesn't make it suitable for money is hard to divide and transport and store and all those kind of things. But absolutely, right now Bitcoin can do all three of those things. I think the earlier you are towards recognizing this as a store of value for the future, or a medium exchange in the future, I think then the bigger the potential upside. So the folks who got in at 2011 obviously going to do better than late folks like myself.
and me too. I'm somewhere in between there.
Yeah.
It took me a couple of years until I finally went, I think I get it now. And then a couple of more years to be like, no, I really get it now. Yeah, Vijay Boyapati did a interview just recently and mentioned, you know, the sort of 20-year rule. There is actually a person who coined it, can't remember who it was, but more or less saying, like, once we get to 20 years, once anything's been around for about 20 years, that's when you reach that critical mass, that point where it has the recognizability for enough people to adopt it. Similar to the internet, you know, up until the point of internet being about 20 years old, it was still being naysayed and hadn't had the complete adoption. But once we hit that, you know, two-decade mark, it just, you know, the tethers are off, essentially. So we'll see. We're still about 7 years away from that. But I guess I agree with you there that it is a speculative store of value. And until it has more of that adoption, it'll probably remain, you know, just sort of heading the right direction, but still in that speculative state.
Yeah. I mean, it would be $1 million if everyone recognized it easy. That's what I would imagine. Its price is currently being suppressed by the fact that a lot of people don't believe in it.
Exactly right.
We just happen to be early. Yeah.
So another point here out of America is Morgan Stanley, which is a US bank. They either released a report or they quoted a report essentially saying that the Lightning Network is basically beats Visa and MasterCard debit cards as a transaction rails because it's sort of faster and cheaper. I know you've looked into this a little bit more than me.
Yeah.
Dow, are you keen to kind of comment?
Yeah. No, I'll share a little bit there. So, yeah, I guess for your listeners, Morgan Stanley, obviously one of the bigger investment banks out there, and recently did a report saying, you know, that the Lightning Network just was more practical, quote unquote, for smaller transactions, recognizing that the sort of 1-3% transaction costs that you have with Visa, Amex, MasterCard, Diners Club, etc., it makes really smaller transactions less feasible. And so I think what they were really speaking to is sort of Jack Mallers' announcement at the Bitcoin conference, where he announced this partnership with BlackHawk, who are the world's largest point of sale crowd. And effectively what it allows people to do is pay in Bitcoin, but then the merchant on the other end gets 100% of the value instead of having 1-3% of value extracted by the intermediaries. In addition, they can also choose whether or not they want to receive it in Satoshis or if they want to get US dollars. So in other words, all they're doing is they're using the Bitcoin, the Bitcoin network as sort of like the payments rail. And this is how I described it to my father-in-law, because I was just saying, like, it's pipes, it's like plumbing, and it's the financial plumbing of the future. And so they're actually recognizing, like, you know, that Bitcoin from a sort of financial payments architecture perspective is actually superior. And to me, you know, that speaks volumes for where we are already. I mean, it says that I personally probably wouldn't be spending my sats all the time, but for those who do want to, it gives the merchants the opportunity to accept Bitcoin without ever having to even touch the asset. And that's the exciting innovation coming out of this piece of news.
Absolutely. And it just shows there's so many like parallel, and I guess there's a bit of crossover, like a Venn diagram here, chains of what's happening in Bitcoin. And most people that I know that are not really into Bitcoin are still stuck on the Bitcoin as an asset. So it's like, is it a store of value? Will it be here in 100 years? How, you know, well can you transfer it or hold it? But to me, the next sort of couple of revolutions that we'll see in terms of people grokking Bitcoin will be the payment rails, like the Bitcoin network itself, the things that you can do on or within the network that aren't really related to Bitcoin, the asset specifically. And of course, Bitcoin mining, I think how that will revolutionize the energy sector. And yeah, the fact that you've got places like Morgan Stanley now recognizing this, whereas I'm sure if we dug back 6 months, 12 months or more, we'd find some negative comments from Morgan Stanley about Bitcoin or about the infrastructure surrounding Bitcoin. So good news.
100%. Yeah, it's the gradually and suddenly thing, I think. And gradually I'm seeing all these amazing pieces of news that are coming out. And I guess, as you say, the average person is really just focused on the price. But, on all the other metrics, it's incredible what's happening in the space. It's so exciting. And yeah, I couldn't be more bullish if I tried.
Definitely. I think that's why I like talking to Bitcoiners, because we actually speak about the fundamentals. Whereas whenever I see friends or family, it's more or less like, oh, how's Bitcoin doing? Like I hear the price is down a bit. I'm like, I don't know, man. Like, depends on the time frame that you're looking at. If it's last week, maybe the price is down. I don't know. But if you're talking about a year or two ago, I think we're still up about five times. So how's your stocks doing? Or people say like, oh, you know, Ethereum's doing a bit better. Why, you know, are you still not, you know, buying that one? It's like, well, let's talk about the fundamentals. Maybe that's more of an interesting conversation.
And totally.
It's probably a good segue, actually, is that there's a couple of news points here that you've come across, I think, with your work with Crypto News. So one being that Uniswap, there's a class action lawsuit against them. And I've summarized this in my own words, which is basically saying that perhaps either Uniswap themselves or perhaps a large user on Uniswap has been sort of found as promoting scam coins or scams and not kind of doing the proper disclosures that would be required of something that might kind of start getting into securities law. Having said that, please correct me if that is wrong, and then yeah, maybe add a bit of the nuance to it from what you've heard about that.
Yeah, I think you sort of covered it there. I mean, essentially, the US is the hotbed of class action lawsuits, if you like, and a couple of aggrieved investors have gotten together and said that Uniswap, a supposedly decentralized exchange, but that is that was funded by a lot of venture capitalists, including A16Z, one of the well-known ones out of Silicon Valley. And I think they've all been listed as respondents to this particular application. So, yeah, it's effectively a case of saying, like, you can't use the defense that, hey, we're decentralized to get away from the responsibility of actually disclosing the nature of what you're actually making available for sale. You know, if you and I wanted to create our own sort of hard block coin, we'd have to disclose a whole lot of stuff to satisfy, you know, the regulatory authorities here in Australia before we could actually sell that legally. But what a lot of these tokens do is they just take advantage of, I guess, a different sort of regulatory system or the lack thereof to get around securities law. So I look at this piece of news as well as the news recently against Coinbase, a centralized exchange for listing 39 coins, of which, if I recall, was Doge one of them? I can't recall offhand, but there were a couple fairly well-known ones, all VC-backed, of course. The signal here, apart from the noise, is really that I'm seeing more and more, I'm seeing this sort of, a wave of regulatory pressure that's going to be applied at the exchange level. So they're not going to be able to go for specific tokens, joke token XYZ. They're going to go against the platforms themselves. And so whether you're decentralized, quote unquote, or centralized, I'm seeing that the tide is shifting. And so this is something that is just across my radar. And I actually take a little bit of comfort from it, because I know that it seems to me that a lot of people have made a lot of money shilling absolute garbage, basically pumping their own bags. I mean, Ape Token is the most recent one. There's like 100 people who own more than 50% of the supply.
And was there, am I right? This, I'm like throwing this in at the last minute, but there was a hack this morning. So Basie's Twitter apes were, and like $50 million or 30, I don't know, some ludicrous amount where I'm like, I don't even know what it means. Has like, has, have other people lost their money, or is that the original inventors of the
people lost apes? Something about 134 bored apes were stolen worth around 2.8 million through some sort of Instagram phishing hack. I mean, there's always these things going on in the space. I saw a macro interview probably about a year ago now, and this chap had been investing through technology cycles over the years, like 20, 30 years, and basically was saying on their models, they're saying around about 2025-ish, 95% of the stuff will be culled. From my perspective, the sooner the better, because yeah. I just think, I mean, it's not about whether or not it's undermining Bitcoin. I just think, and I'm not one to sort of encourage regulation for the sake of it, but, you know, buy beware, as it were. But it just seems to me that you've got these two separate regulatory schemes operating, you know, the one for people trying to do things by the letter of the law, and then you've got these, you know, packaged in blockchain, and suddenly you can do what you want.
That's it. And look, that one of the last points that you made there was on my mind too, is like, I really hate to be the one that says we need regulation, because I don't normally say that. But at the same time, it definitely doesn't seem like an even playing field. It definitely seems like there are a lot of rug pulls and scams and people that were being put off the industry because of it, or losing, you know, life savings, etc., because of it. So to some degree, I think we're heading the right direction if we're going to see more and more of either these kind of shit coins become regulated securities, which means probably most of them wouldn't exist anymore. Or of course, if there's more of a clampdown on centralized and even maybe, you know, decentralized exchanges, because a lot of them aren't actually decentralized, to say, well, you shouldn't be issuing or making these available to your users because they are meant to be regulated securities. So wherever the strangle kind of point is that regulations use, I do think it's at least in the meantime heading the right direction if there's going to be a merging of these sort of two regulatory frameworks that seem to be in use at the moment. And I'm confident that none of that is going to be a bad thing for Bitcoin. And in fact, we'll probably just shuttle people more towards Bitcoin in the first place.
Yeah, 100%.
So I guess we'll find out pretty soon how many of these decentralized projects are actually decentralized, and how corrupt some of them are in terms of things like pre-mines and what's been promised and where the money actually comes from in terms of paying back investors, etc. So yeah, interesting times
for sure.
The other point here, which is kind of related, is that the Robinhood CEO made an announcement about, you know, Doge maybe becoming the currency of the, you know, the people and the internet. And of course, there's a bit of a conflict of interest there, because Robinhood has Doge as a potential coin that you could own. And so this could be a circumstance of someone pumping their own bags. Having said that, a bit of like a tangent news where, so Vlad, one of the developers of Doge, had a very, very long thread about, you know, how do we make Doge the, I think you're probably riffing off this Robinhood CEO's comment saying, how do we make it the currency of the people and the internet? And they're talking about having everything scaled on the base layer. Probably haven't learned anything from the block size wars and looking into like SegWit and SegWit2x, because what they want to do is have up to about a gigabyte of data on each block. And really the argument is about, well, how often should blocks be? Like maybe we start at 10 minutes per block and then we go down to like 1 minute per block over the next few years. And maybe we get even to like a few seconds per block so we can make sure we can have everything scaled. Of course, if you're talking about like a gigabyte per block, I don't even know. I can't even do the maths on that. Like no one owns a computer or, you know, storage device at home that could ever run a node like that. You would need to essentially outsource most of it to like an Amazon web service or some sort of cloud server. I don't know. Lots of weird stuff going on in this space, which feels like it's arguments that have already been had years ago with Bitcoin. But yeah, did you have any comments, I guess, even about that, just the original story with the Robinhood CEO making the comment about Doge?
It's obscenely stupid. There's just no other way to put it. Unfortunately, yeah, it reminded me of a scene from my favorite movie, The Big Lebowski, where Donnie wanders in and John Goodman's character screams at him. He says, like, you're a child wandering into the middle of a movie and wants to know what's happening. Because it's just like a film, like, that's what's happening here. Because it's just like, come on, man. Like, this stuff has been, this was 4 years ago. Like, people were having these debates and discussions. I mean, you know, it speaks to a little bit of hubris as well, like you can have an opinion on everything. But also, I think what's most important is like over a third of the Doge supply is actually held on the Robinhood platform. So,
gotcha,
I go follow the money, I guess. But I just thought it was really funny because I just, and this was an article that I wrote because I just thought it was really quite hilarious.
And it's kind of the whole, I just discovered Bitcoin and I'm here to fix it.
Yes.
It's sort of, congruent with that to some degree, isn't it? It's like not a decision of like, do we scale on the base layer? It's like, and how hard do we scale on the base layer? And like, can we make this currency the currency of the people on the internet? Because surely it's just as simple as us all deciding that that's the best one to use or having enough marketing budget. Like, no, I think it might be a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah. Maybe. Yes, exactly.
Well, look, a bit of news, which is just I've included as more of a sort of funny news than anything else. So new analysis of Roman coins uncovers evidence of financial crisis. So it's a new scientific analysis of the composition of the Roman denarii, essentially finding that coin clipping, which I think most people in Bitcoin are aware of, they determined that, look, that definitely was happening, and it was happening probably worse than what we all expect. Interestingly, when looking into this story and some of the little offshoots of stories from it, I found that there seems to be a bit of debate still with historians of like, was there even a financial crisis in Rome? Maybe Rome collapsed for other reasons and finances weren't very much to do with it. Or maybe it happened, but it wasn't as bad as what some of the writers and philosophers of the time thought. Whereas this new analysis is finding that, yes, it was quite as bad as what we thought. And perhaps it's actually much worse than that. So probably not news for Bitcoiners, but I just find it interesting that we're still discovering things from literally, hundreds and even up to 1,000 years ago that are just, common knowledge to Bitcoiners' vernacular.
Totally. Yeah. And if people have the opportunity to increase the supply, and debase the currency, those in power, we all like to think that we would be the exception, but this is just human nature. It's happened for thousands and thousands of years, and that's the beauty of Bitcoin. It's predetermined, programmed, and there's no humans involved because we mess things up basically.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I mean that's such an interesting piece of information that's uncovered.
I think you're right. It's a matter of time until when we print, if we're allowed to, and then after that, the matter of time is shorter and the amount we print is more. It's just like invariable. It has to happen that way. And of course, when you have a debt-based system with fractional reserve banking, like it can only go that direction. So it's amazing that we're still debating whether that happened thousands of years ago or not. But I love it. I love seeing more confirmation like, yes, it was indeed.
Yeah.
All right. So shifting to Australian news, a couple of regulatory things have come out recently. So the Australian Financial Watchdog has unveiled their crypto regulatory approach. So to summarize, they're doing quite a bit of consultation over this year and next year and have the intention to set up a new regulatory framework throughout 2024 and 2025 with it to be finalized around 2025. And that would probably include new legislation and ways to not just integrate digital assets, so like Bitcoin and shitcoins, into the existing financial frameworks, but to actually have a new financial framework that is specifically for digital assets. So this is, I don't like regulation, but this is good to me because there are a lot of, I think, institutional investors and even retail investors that are waiting for regulatory clarity. And there's also probably a lot of users that are waiting to see that if they adopt, say, a Bitcoin standard, they are not going to then be at odds with their government in the next couple of years. And so it certainly seems like Australia is saying, we don't want to stifle, we want to encourage innovation, but we want to do it in a way that protects consumers and that still gives us the same level of, I guess, surveillance that they do have with other types of financial assets and the financial system at the moment. So look, overall, I see it as good news. It's also good news, the fact that it's going to take them about sort of 3 years or so from here to get to the point of finality, which means there's still a lot of time in between now and then to stack and not be too concerned and just to sort of watch and see what happens and to comment. If you're involved in a business that has any sort of influence with this, you normally get invites to consult on some of the papers that come out. So I would say, put your two cents in, but otherwise watch this space. Related to that, AUSTRAC came out with two new guides to help spot illicit crypto use. So these are two separate bits of news, but I'd say that this is all being kind of orchestrated in a centralized way behind the scenes to say, look, while we have this regulatory approach that we're firming up for the next 3 years, let's actually put out some guidelines to say, if you are an exchange or if you are any kind of institution that deals with digital assets, how do you make sure that your users are protected and that also your users aren't doing anything dodgy? Again, I don't overall disagree with the premise of doing something like that, especially because these do seem to be more like guidelines rather than strict requirements. However, there's some strange stuff that was in there. There was some stuff that could be interpreted in many ways, in the sense of saying if someone uses a VPN or if they use an encrypted email provider like ProtonMail, for example, or if they're using things like on browsers, you can get a little plugin that stops it being able to be fingerprinted, because that is a large way that you're identified now online, not just from your IP address. With which a VPN would cover. It's really things like, what kind of graphics card are you using? What's the screen resolution that you're on? What's the time set on your computer? And a lot of that is actually put out by your browser. So if you were to have browser fingerprinting turned off, essentially these AUSTRAC guidelines are saying, that's very suspicious. VPN fingerprinting turned off, using an encrypted email. Is that something that's suspicious? Does that warrant further follow-up? They even had things in there saying, like, if you withdrew and then converted it to another chain, or if you withdrew and then entered into a centralized mixing service, which I don't recommend people do anyway, there's plenty of non-custodial ways to mix your coins. They're saying that could be suspicious as well. So I don't know. It's a sort of a slippery slope with some of these things. What do you reckon, Dale?
Yeah. Look, I think, with regards to the first little piece of news, I think, I agree. Regulatory clarity is quite important. I think a lot of people need that sort of stamp of approval. So, perhaps people like us and some of your listeners might just, be happy to make decisions on their own accord, whereas I suspect the average person is more inclined to wait for kind of the stamp of approval. I know a lot of people in my circles who, they, once the government says green light, go, then it's okay. So I think overall that's probably good. I my main concern would be in relation to failing to distinguish between Bitcoin and other assets. That's as simple as it, or the other cryptocurrencies or tokens or whatever you want to call them. If you've done the work, they're fundamentally different. One's more commodity-like, whereas the shitcoins and any other token is more like a security. And so I really hope that over the coming 2 to 3 years, Bitcoiners can have their voice heard. I know through the Bitcoin industry body, they're doing a lot of good work trying to help inform regulators about what's actually happening. So that's kind of just a little bit of a red flag. And I think, when it comes to these guides, and a lot of this regulation, it's always done for, with this hypothetical criminal in mind, as if there's no other justifications for wanting things like privacy. And so we do need to treat these things with a degree of suspicion. And I think we need to try and, again, constructively engage with industry as much as we can as Bitcoiners to at least ensure that the regulations don't go too far. Like a sledgehammer to kill a fly kind of thing. And I think that's often what tends to happen. And I think also what we need to do is be very much cognizant of the broader framework, legislative framework that we live in. So, I'm not sort of too privy to all of the moving parts, but there are a lot of concerning pieces of legislation today that give government overreach, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of being able to literally hack into your email. If you don't have some sort of encrypted email, if you're deemed to be someone who's suspicious for some other reason, suspected of a crime, you can, if you've got a Gmail, whatever, they could just go to you, they can get into your Facebook, your Gmail, whatever the case may be. So I think we need to look at that more broadly. And I tend to encourage people to try and think about their privacy more. You do great work in that space. I've got to up my game even more. And there's a lot of people who are doing it a lot better than I, but I think, I guess those are the only comments I have.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And that particular piece of legislation came out like about halfway through COVID, didn't it? And it's called something like the intercept and disrupt. And basically what they're allowed to do is, impersonate you, write messages that you never wrote, change messages that you did write to fit a particular purpose. If they think that you're involved in anything, or if they think that anyone that you know is involved in anything and they could therefore get those people through you. The part that really frustrates me about that legislation, I guess the whole thing does, but even more so, is that they no longer have to get a warrant to do that. I say they, I'm talking about police here. So they don't have to get a warrant. They can go through and it's an internal administrative appeals section of the police department, so staffed by other police, to ask, you know, we think we have enough evidence to be able to get into this person's account and send emails from them to, you know, entrap someone else. So no longer is that now separated by it going to like the legal system. It all is held internally. So less checks and balances and more power is usually, again, slippery slope, doesn't end well.
Absolutely. I think that there's, I might have mentioned to you this in our long form discussion, I think there's a huge opportunity for somebody to create like a turnkey service which says, let's de-Googlefy you, let's get all of these things, and let's help set up genuinely private services, because to a lot of people, they'll always choose convenience over privacy, whatever's easy. And as you said, I think earlier in this discussion, you know, we are the product. It's free, so we're the product. And so you're giving up a lot of information. And yeah, when I look holistically at kind of the regulatory stuff, on the whole, I tend to be fairly cynical about these things, because I think if they are to be abused, if they can be abused, they will be. And I suspect the threshold is often a little bit too low for some of the exercise of power. I think we saw a lot of that during the pandemic. So yeah, let's see what happens. Like, watch the space. And if you've got skin in the game, I think make your voice heard if it's your inclination.
Agreed. Yeah. And I guess two final points that just popped into mind. One being that you're right. Whenever you talk to people that aren't really into Bitcoin, they are waiting for that green light, aren't they? Because most people say, what if it gets banned? Like, that's still a bit of a FUD point. And, you know, you can talk about game theory and the fact that it's an open network and it's a global network, etc. But most people are still like, yeah, but what about my government? What if my government bans it? So I think once people get that green light, again, this regulation is helpful in that regard, even though it might not be like overall net positive for people's, you know, privacy and freedom. The other point, just starting to slip my mind, however, it's almost there, is...
I've got 2 cents to add.
Yeah,
that
please
I think
do.
Links into what we're saying, actually, yeah. Is that I just wrote a story yesterday about Ukraine, who's been the darling of late for, you know, the media. And they got like 120 million odd dollars in crypto donations, and so your so-called crypto fans around the world are chucking their funds through there and say, come on, we'll beat Russia. And then they come out and say, listen, you're not allowed to buy any cryptocurrencies with the local with your own currency, the hryvnia. I'm probably butchering the pronunciation. So they're basically banning people from buying with their own currency. And if you are happen to be, I guess, part of the elite who have foreign currency, and I'm speaking as like a South African, where I'm thinking, how many South Africans actually have US dollars? Like an infinitesimally small amount of the 60 odd million people, right? Then you can buy 3,400 US per month of crypto. So, you know, how's that? I thought, like, talk about banning your citizens from the network.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of the point I raised at the end was really like, you're effectively denying these people like a financial lifeline. You know, this economic impoverishment is virtually guaranteed when you consider the fact that this is like a war-torn country. People want to be able to send money overseas. They want to take their money. They want to leave. So there's an example of a country that looked to be very progressive, but, you know, sort of has now reined it all in. Whereas I compare it to Australia, and I'm thinking, I think the Australian government, which may or may not change in the next few months, I suspect, though, that there is still this desire in this region to have a much more friendly environment. So I think it's more US style as opposed to kind of what we just saw out of Ukraine.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because it did certainly seem like they were adopting a lot of different crypto, not just Bitcoin, asking for donations throughout the beginning of the war. And then now, yeah, you're right, just saying, okay, we don't want you spending our own money on that. It's only if you have foreign currencies, which is very restrictive. But I do feel like we have a different culture around personal investment here in Australia, which interestingly, again, in that Senator Bragg Ask Me Anything, he did mention something along those lines where someone was asking about superannuation funds and should there be some strict requirements on how much you can have in crypto. And he said, look, there's already obligations around diversifications, and there is a strong culture in Australia and the regulations around it, around personal investments and that being up to people and it's their money to do what they wish. Well, that's a very good sign. And that's quite different to what we're seeing elsewhere.
100%.
I did remember that point too. So it was actually based on something that you said about how hopefully some of these regulations will recognize that other cryptocurrencies are quite different to Bitcoin. I'm going to mention something. I'm pretty sure this isn't confidential, but this will be a part of the Australian Bitcoin industry body's response to the digital asset framework consultation request. And it was to say that for exchanges to be legitimately looking after their users' best interests, they really should be running a node to make sure that they can verify the coins that they hold. Bitcoin, for example, is abiding by the consensus rules and it's legitimate Bitcoin and it hasn't been spent previously, etc. And so that's pretty easy to do for Bitcoin exchanges. So what would be really good if all the other shitcoin casinos, if they run their own nodes for all of those individual shitcoins as well, that would actually provide a really great amount of user protection. That's being suggested back with the understanding and the full knowledge that like no one is going to be able to run a full node for most of these coins.
He's going to run a Doge node.
Exactly. And if you have 50 different tokens, you're going to run 50 different nodes and all of them require their own specific cloud service provider and virtual private service. Like it's just not going to happen. But at the same time, like it's a legitimate request to say, well, look, we're doing our best to make sure like we're actually selling legitimate Bitcoin and that, you know, we're holding it under the right, you know, framework, et cetera. Why don't we do this for the other 10,000 shitcoins? You know, it should be just as easy, right? Because if they're decentralized and they're verifiable and they're auditable, like we should just do that. I'd love if the government said, that's great. That's a great idea. Let's do that. And every other crypto exchange is like, shit, we need to have a partnership with Amazon Web Services just to be able to have all these nodes that have a gig per second and blocks or something.
The problem is, yeah, with a lot of these exchanges, I think the incentive to list shitcoins is so great because people trade them. You know, like it's not as it's like crowds like, you know, Hardblock and Bitrue and, you know, Fast Bitcoins and others, like, you know, you've deliberately decided to reduce your market share because you could easily make a lot more money by listing shitcoins because they move. There's a lot of, like, you know, there's a lot of volume and there's a lot of fees to be made. Whereas definitely, if you buy into the Bitcoin ethos, which is buy and hold, like there's really, like there's not a lot of trading as much. Obviously people still trade it, but I guess you know what I'm saying here. I mean, absolutely, I guess you'd say like you trade. If I'm a trader, if I'm coming to this space, I'm trading shitcoins because they are a lot more volatile than Bitcoin. And
definitely.
And if I've got a little bit of insider knowledge, even better.
Yeah, very true. And look, it is. I know from Hardbox perspective, that's probably the main one that I can comment on. They have done themselves out of quite a lot of financial benefit from turning away shitcoins all, you know, throughout the last, since about 2014 when they set up. So, but yeah, at the same time, you know, to their detriment financially, but I think that's a positive for their brand and anyone who is a true Bitcoiner is really who they want as a customer. So it kind of works out well for that ethos. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, the money, the marketing, just the trade volume and everything else, it's with the shitcoins. And it probably will be for the foreseeable future too.
Yeah, that's right, man.
So another bit of news here from Australia. So Australia's first spot ETF gets the green light. Now, there's a bit of nuance to this news. So this is meant to be out by the end of April, which I think is meant to be this week. So we'll see. And initially, the way that the news was put out there was that there was this 42% margin requirement. And that sounded like whatever they buy with the ETF or whatever they provide to their customers for the ETF, they need to make sure it's backed by 42% Bitcoin. That's not actually what it means. So some Australian funds are buying a Canadian ETF, and I believe there might be an American ETF in there too, but definitely a Canadian ETF. But to be allowed to do that and offer it to their clients, they need to hold around 42% of the offering of what they're going to give to their clients, just in case their clients and customers don't subscribe to this ETF as much as what they expected. So I think this is still good news. It's still a spot ETF. It has also opened up the conversation with some of these funds to say, not only do we want to buy the Canadian ETF and make that available to our clients and we'll hold 42% of whatever we make available, but we also want to now start working on having our own Bitcoin spot ETFs in Australia issued by the fund themselves. So there's like BetaShares, I think VanEck, there's a few others that are looking at doing this in Australia now. But in the meantime, it sounds like within the next couple of days, we may have access to a Bitcoin ETF. I don't know why you buy a Bitcoin ETF. You should just buy Bitcoin, but still spot ETF is better than a futures ETF.
Totally. However, we could broaden the tent, I say. But yeah, on an individual level, I think it makes zero sense. But I think for institutions, it makes all the sense in the world. I think what's really interesting to me is that in the investment universe, we all have access to all of these other funds anyway. So I'm just not quite sure what the upside here, because it's a fund of funds, as you described.
Yeah.
So the first one is the Cosmos Bitcoin ETF, and that's actually the coins are going to be held by Gemini Offshore. On the same day, there'll be another one listed, and that's the 21 shares. I don't actually know exactly how that is going to be, what that's constituted of, but those are going to be also custodied by offshore by Coinbase. And none of it's happening locally. Mm. And what's interesting too is that neither of these two are listing on the ASX. So they're listing on sort of the secondary market, the CBOE.
That's right. Yeah.
So I think that's quite telling. It's interesting. So the question is, is this good or bad? I think overall, this is really good for Bitcoin. I think it just legitimizes in the eyes of individuals, in institutional eyes, if you like. And it just broadens the tent. So go for it. When I think of, I guess just for your listeners' benefit, the difference being obviously with the futures exchange is where you're really just basing the value of the ETF on futures contracts. And so you're not actually getting exposure to the underlying asset, but rather the contracts, whereas this is actually now a spot ETF based on the price, and it'll be tracking the Aussie dollar price. So if you want a quick, easy way and you don't care about holding your own coins and all that jazz, and you want to just trade it in your CommSec account, then by all means. But I personally wouldn't recommend it to individuals though.
Likewise, I guess for people that aren't probably really big in the space at the moment in terms of investing and understanding the fundamentals, this does make it, it's a nice intermediary step, I think, for the others, institutions or retail buyers that have been looking to dabble into Bitcoin but thought that it was unsafe. At least now they have a few avenues to do that. And I imagine this would be very motivating for the funds that are buying into this other fund overseas to then get their own funds set up, especially if they have a really high subscription rate to that ETF. So good news regardless.
Yeah. And I think the fact that we got two on the same day, I think it just speaks to some of the kind of the race to be first. You want to be able to market and say, we're the first Bitcoin ETF. I think the subsequent ones are going to be more, going to be less fund of funds, and they actually probably, hopefully, we'll see ones that are essentially where the assets are actually custodied here in Australia. So it's actually backed here, but not by another ETF, but by actual Bitcoin here in cold storage. So yeah, but it remains to be seen. I think it's all just very good. It's super exciting. It's just another kind of green check for the normies to say, yep, the water's not that cold. Let's jump right in.
Exactly right. Two bits of news that I'll talk about at the same time, which are almost a complete opposite of what we're talking about now. So the Sunday Morning Herald, Sydney Morning Herald, I did this last time when we talked about it too, but either
Sydney.
Way.
Sydney, I think.
Thank you.
Equally irrelevant, respectfully.
Exactly, yeah. So this paper came out with two articles on the same day. One talks about how life is getting very expensive and houses are becoming, really expensive, but they're still affordable. And, you can save for a house deposit just using the old legacy system avenues. So save more regularly, find a high interest saving account, which doesn't really exist, but I don't know if you get a percent or something like that, maybe that's a high interest saving account nowadays. Move out of the city and go regional because that makes houses a bit more affordable. Buy some stocks and ETFs and shares. Maybe save in your super for a while and then deduct it later on at retirement to buy your house, or even leverage your parents' property if they've paid it off. And these are the suggestions. And they make it all very, very hopeful that you can buy a house using these ways, which I'm pretty sure those are the ways that people are trying to save for a house now anyway. Now, there was another article by different author, but in the same media outlet, that talks about how impulsive psychopaths like cryptocurrency and specifically Bitcoin. And that was based on a study of, I think, about 500 people that did a survey, basically saying that, psychopaths are more likely to take the risks on things like Bitcoin. And so those seem like two different articles. And I guess they are specifically. But at the same time, I can see a big crossover here. It sort of says like houses are more expensive, but here's some great ways to save. Certainly don't look into Bitcoin because that's for psychopaths. End of story.
Yeah, that is interesting. I think the Sydney Morning one was really, or Sydney Herald story was classic, because it's a little tone deaf, you know. It sort of says, you know, like assumes, okay, your parents have their own homes. It says like, okay, I've got a job that enables me to move to a regional area. And which ironically, like certain regional areas have actually got a lot more expensive, like a lot more, even more so than the urban centers. It doesn't speak at all to the reason why the property prices are inflated, of course. And that psychopath one I thought was, frankly, it's quite hilarious, because, you know, you can say that, sometimes if you hop onto Bitcoin Twitter, it can appear as if there's a couple of psychopaths, but at least just to the untrained eye, you know, tough love, you can call it even. But psychopaths, I don't know. I see Bitcoin is offering a lot more hope for the future.
Absolutely.
It's academia in inverted commas. Like, to me, I think that it just speaks to A, the disconnect between these academic institutions and real people. And then also just like, I just think it's just so patently obvious that these institutions are slowly, the trust in these institutions is becoming, has eroded so fast. And I think that, like, say 20 years from now, it's not obvious to me that people's first inclination after school is go to uni. You know, I think I would recommend it probably just from a social aspect, but beyond that, if there are other mechanisms, I don't see the point. I mean, some of the brightest minds in Bitcoin dropped out of uni and they're 20 years old, you know?
Absolutely. I love how this news has been adopted by Bitcoiners as well. Like the amount of people that are selling like psychopath t-shirts and like just calling themselves psychopaths and saying like, I didn't want to take the normal path. I wanted the psycho path. And it's like all these different riffs and memes from like, I love it. This is why I love the internet, and especially Bitcoiners on the internet, because someone throws something at us that's meant to be derogatory, just gets adopted and then just thrown back.
Absolutely. Brilliant. Absolutely.
So last bit of Australian news here. So Alex Saunders, who started and ran Nuggets News, which I think a lot of Bitcoiners, especially Australian Bitcoiners, and anyone who's into the crypto space kind of more broadly, would probably know that name. Like, I know when I was first getting into it around sort of 2017, 2018 and beyond, I was starting to listen to a lot more of Alex's content. He had a lot of macroeconomics built in there, and it was very educational. Talked a lot about, fractional reserve banking and, you know, government regulation. And over time, I ended up sort of opting out of his podcast because it sounded a lot more like shitcoinery as it got towards the end of it. And then he kind of dropped off the face of the earth, and there was lots of news about how people had invested quite a bit of money. That money hadn't been returned. I don't have all the detail about exactly what he invested in or what he was meant to be investing in, etc. But either way, a lot of people got burnt, and a lot of the people that he'd partnered with kind of gradually stepped away in terms of their relationship with him. And then he quite literally dropped off the face of the earth. I don't think he posted any sort of announcements about why or what or anything. You know, almost like 6 to 12 months later, there was another article I read about how some people are now taking him to court over that. However, now very recently, just in the last week or so, Alex has sort of resurfaced to say a lot of those issues that came up, a lot of the malinvestments were due to, I think, a back injury and some chronic back pain, some opioid use or even opioid abuse, and then gambling as well. And like, I want to be diplomatic here because I understand that is a real thing. And even in terms of the work that I've just come from, like, I used to work quite a lot with chronic pain clients, and there was substance abuse in there, and there was sometimes other sort of avoidance-based strategies, things like gambling. So I know this is definitely a conceptualization that impacts a lot of people. And I guess the point that I want to bring across with this is that Alex had built a really good reputation and a really good relationship with a lot of the community, like literal thousands and maybe even tens of thousands of people. And so I think a lot of those people would now be very quick to jump back in and to listen to Alex and to take his advice. Or if he has, say, like an investment coming up, to even invest in it and think, okay, well, he's, you know, he's all fixed up now, he's good to go, and he's now back into the scene. So I would just say, like, buyer beware. Past performance is not always the perfect indicator of future performance, but you should definitely take into account what's happened in the past. And although I hope personally, you know, Alex is, you know, truly on the mend and he comes good in the fullness of time, I think anyone who's is really keen about his return and is glad and wants to get investment advice and start paying a subscription again, I would say just, you know, temper your expectations, maybe even watch it from the sidelines for a little while. And just to see if there's any other red flags that come up, because I feel like this could be a, yeah, it could be a bit of a trap for a lot of people that had built that rapport and that relationship with him to now just jump straight back into what feels familiar.
Yeah. I remember covering the story at the time because there was a big spat between him and this Richard Hart of Hex. And he sort of sent out a bunch of screenshots saying, "Oh, you know, here's Alex begging me for some Bitcoin," and he's bragging about, "I'm the richest man in Tasmania, and I drive a Subaru, and I hate half my listeners and all my subscribers." Wow. And all this kind of like these texts. Now again, and this is the era of the internet, so people can fabricate stuff. And look, you know, with respect to old, I wouldn't necessarily trust Richard Hart with a dollar of mine. So yeah, I don't know. I can't speak to the credibility or any of this. And as you say, you can't really, you never want to underplay people's personal battles. And let's be honest, the last couple of years have been incredibly challenging for all sorts of reasons. But at the same time, and this is my personal view, it didn't appear as if the statement, which you can actually go and have a look on Twitter if you like, it didn't appear to me to reflect an individual who had gone through, the battle and come out and taken a bit of personal responsibility. It kind of smacked of self-pity and, "Oh, by the way, here's an upcoming NFT project." And so to my mind, I personally would advise, people to DYOR, as it were. To the extent that it is legitimate, one really hopes that he's overcome whatever challenges he has. I know opioid addiction can be an awful thing, but I still think one needs to take personal responsibility for taking advantage of people whose trust you've abused. And I think I consumed a fair bit of his contents when it came to the macro side. He used to have a weekly show with a chap called Martin North from yep. Digital Finance Analytics, and that was sort of my, alternative media for all things real estate, because I was looking at all the stuff in the news and saying, like, all you chaps are doing is just pumping the market. I mean, I need somebody to give me actual data here. And so they used to have this weekly chat, it was, for 90% of people, would be quite boring. It was quite dry and sterile, but like, it was interesting. It was a lot of good data. It's certainly interesting that he's making a comeback, but it's not, to me, respectfully, it's not surprising that there are NFTs in the pipeline. So it's an easy way to monetize an audience, frankly.
Absolutely. And look, playing devil's advocate, reading between the lines, it certainly is. If I had learnt my lesson, so to speak, and I had an apology to give, I wouldn't be putting it onto the things that exacerbated the problem. I wouldn't be saying that's what caused it. I would say, look, I made decisions. And I've made promises that have been broken, and here's some external factors that were a part of it. But look, it is my personal responsibility. And if I then had an NFT collection that I was going to release, I probably wouldn't do it in that same kind of announcement.
Yes, exactly.
Because it just seems a little bit too much.
It's too much. And I don't know who gave him that advice, because to me, exactly that point. And if you're in a relationship with people, let's say if you've got a partner, do you want to be apologizing, but, or do you just want to say, "I was wrong"?
Yep.
End of story. And that's what I think is missing from my perspective, because that would be indicative of someone who's sincere. I think when you're making excuses, however valid they are, I think it removes, I guess it waters down the sincerity in my eyes. But yeah, I wish him all the best. And yeah, folks, keep your eyes out, see what happens. Who knows?
That's it. So moving on to technology news. I'll go through these relatively quickly because they're more or less just headlines for people to be aware of. Some of them pretty bullish, and this first one's just more useful. So there's a new Bitcoin seed calculator tool that was launched by Bitcoin Q&A. And so I'll put the link in the description. But what this lets you do, it's very similar to Ian Coleman's BIP39 utility, if you've ever used that before. It essentially lets you generate entropy, or even just enter in, say, like your seed phrase and your passphrase. I wouldn't enter your own. This is more like just to sort of play around with. Having said that, both are free and open source software, so you can tell that they're not trying to steal your seed phrase. You can take both of them offline and use them offline, which means you know that it's secure in that regard. But the main use of it is, if you have no idea how a seed phrase is linked to the binary entropy before it, or how the seed phrase is linked to like your extended private key, your extended public key, all the various addresses, the derivation paths of whether it's like a legacy address or a SegWit address, as well as things like BIP49, PayNim, payment codes, like how are those derived from it? All these things are very confusing. So this calculator tool actually lets you play around with that to say like, all right, well, let's just say these are my 12 seed words. What would the entropy of that look like? And in this new tool, it actually even lets you say, like, say if you wanted to generate entropy and didn't want to just let it be responsible to like a random number generator that's used by the website, maybe you could use dice or maybe you could use playing cards. There's all these various ways you can kind of generate entropy to then get your seed words and then see how your seed words becomes your private key, your public key, and then all the individual child private and public keys and receiving addresses that that derive from there. So if that doesn't sound interesting, it's probably not going to be that interesting for you when you look at it. But if that sounds like something where like, yeah, I wouldn't mind just seeing how that works and, you know, you change a value and see how the rest of the values change just to understand how these things are all linked together, there's a really cool site. And of course, if you ever need to check your backups, it can also be a very useful site if you're using it offline, just to be able to put your seed, your passphrase in, if you're using a passphrase, and just to double check, like, okay, yes, I can still generate the same receiving addresses as I could originally when I sent these funds into it, if you have like cold storage or something like that. So just a good utility to check out. So the other bits of news here around the Lightning Network. So there was a report that essentially came out around 2021's Lightning growth, saying that it had grown over 750%, which is a huge amount. And on top of that, very recently, the Lightning channels volume or capacity reached a new all-time high, which is around 3,700 Bitcoin. So it's pretty cool. I guess we know that Lightning is being used more. And you could probably tell from just like Bitcoin base layer, it hasn't been very congested in terms of the mempool. I would say this is part of it. A lot of those transactions are quite likely happening on Lightning. And the use of Lightning keeps growing as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, just to add briefly to that, I did a piece 2 weeks ago where there was some funds raised by Lightning Labs to essentially what they call Bitcoinize the dollar. And effectively, it was this protocol, Taro, that allowed, and building on top of Taproot, a previous update sort of in November, if I recall, and it effectively allows you to issue things like stable coins on the Bitcoin network. And so if this is successful, I mean, not only will we see Lightning just explode, but it also just really calls into question the use case and value of a lot of these altcoins or whatever they are. So I think Lynn Alden said in 21 that people are sleeping on the Lightning Network. And this was like in January. And she then kind of revisited that now and said, yep, I think I was on track. And
absolutely,
incredible. It's incredible to see what's happening here. And, you know, the glacial speed at which things happen in Bitcoin relative to that, let's just break things and change things with everything else. I think you're starting to see paid dividends in the form of these really robust, scalable, long-term solutions. And I think they're going to just eat the lunch of all the other altcoins.
I agree. Like if I was to hold a stable coin, I'm not sure why we call them stable coins because we know that they go down in value over time. But say if I was to hold a currency on, as they call it, a stable coin, I would rather it be backed by sats. So to be sitting on top of the Lightning Network rather than being on a chain like Tron or Ethereum or Binance or any of the other cryptocurrency chains that have their own stable coins. So I'd much rather hold a stable coin, essentially backed by Bitcoin.
And totally. I mean, what's crazy is if you think about, like, I've messed around with USDC and those kind of other stable coins, like, what's crazy is when each time you transfer it, you know, and you got this ERC-20 protocol, you wouldn't believe the fees. It's obscene. And if I want to transmit like a couple hundred dollars, it could cost like $10-$20 worth, or, you know, to actually send that. And you think to yourself, well, that's not great. Whereas if Taro does what we think it can do, you know, you'd be able to send stable coins between each other for like a penny, you know. And so, I mean, to me, again, that's also, you know, and sort of Bitcoin adoption in developing nations, being able to assist with international remittances, that kind of thing. If you didn't necessarily want Bitcoin, you wanted to do US dollars or whatever it was, the stable coin, whether centralized or decentralized, I think this is all a win for Bitcoin in the end.
Absolutely. And the beautiful thing is that Taro is just one of the protocols doing exactly this. So there's been a bit of drama about how Taro is just a repurposing of RGB, which has been around for a few years now. But Taro actually utilizes some of the Taproot functionality, whereas RGB, I don't think, does. And also RGB doesn't seem as far along in development. It's more kind of conceptual. There's also Synonym, which is looking at doing the same sort of thing. So I think over time, we're going to see more and more of these layer three solutions. So the ones that are built on top of layer two, which is Lightning Network, that are looking at integrating tokens, whatever the token might be, stablecoin or otherwise. And yeah, interesting just to watch that space and see what is going to gain that network effect, essentially, who will be the first mover and who will have the most the functionality to gain the most users.
Yeah, for sure.
So a final point here, and then I also realized we missed one bit of news, but it's a very quick bit of news, so I'll go back. But a final point is so just some bullish news about Bitcoin, another stat. So over 64% of all Bitcoin has not moved in over a year, which is the highest amount of Bitcoin that hasn't moved in a year that's ever recorded. So hodlers are hodling and taking it off exchanges. It doesn't really matter what happens to the price so much. That number seems to keep growing, which is really cool. So the news that I skipped was around the US inflation. So having just called you a stablecoin, not really a stablecoin, maybe that's a good segue. So the US inflation rate, the annual inflation rate hit 8.5% in March, which means between March 2021 and March 2022, they're at an inflation of now 8.5%. That is the highest in 40 years. Although interestingly, if you use the CPI calculation methodology from 40 years ago, the current inflation is probably around 17%. Not 8.5%. So I guess just an interesting stat for you. And it's just, yeah, insane to think in 8 or 9 years, you would lose the majority of your wealth if you were holding it in US dollars.
Absolutely. And what's quite insane is that, you know, the CPI is completely artificially constructed. And as Lynn Alden recently said in a discussion, she said, whenever they make changes to it, it's never to increase the CPI. It's always going to be decreasing. And so, like, when it comes to housing, for example, we all know, like, here in Australia as well as in the US, housing, whether you're renting or whether you want to buy, it's gone through the roof. So in the US, it's actually increased by 17%, which mirrors the inflation stats if you use shadow stats from 1980, right? But what they use these days is something called like owner's equivalent in rent, which is only 4%. And so you take into the fact that, you know, like, and Saylor's had a lot of good points about inflation, saying like, everyone's inflation is actually different. I mean, if you're not a homeowner, your inflation is different to if you're a homeowner versus somebody who's paid off their home. Et cetera, et cetera. So like where you are at the stage of your life, whether or not you have assets or not, what are the types of things you tend to spend your money on? It seems quite obvious to, I think, Bitcoiners that CPI is actually, it's almost a political tool, if anything. And even the notion that somehow the money that we have must somehow constantly inflate and must constantly be debased, just by virtue of its existence, is quite strange. So, yeah, it's really telling. About 40-odd% of that is energy. So energy costs have soared in the US, and a lot of it is due to some of their malinvestment they basically are decommissioning a lot of reliable energy sources in exchange for these sort of more unreliable green technologies, which most of us would support, but they need to be economically feasible and actually provide energy.
Definitely. Yeah, you're right. And just the whole measure of CPI is, it's like, where do you start? The way that Saylor puts it, CPI is a vector, and yet it really depends. Everyone has their own individual basket of goods. And if you look at something like a digital or an industrialized asset, it doesn't have, actually, those are deflationary for the most part. If you look at an asset that has variable inputs like energy costs and labor costs, then that tends to have a higher inflation rate. If something is perishable, it tends to have a higher inflation rate. Similar to if something is indestructible or a store of value, it has a higher inflation rate. So just to say like CPI is 3 or 8 or whatever is just, it's a ludicrous proposition because it depends on what it is that you're measuring. And I guess that's the other point is if the basket that you're measuring by changes every time you measure it, it's never a comparison. And of course, if CPI goes up, as in inflation goes up and the strength of the dollar goes down, that is likely to influence people's spending behavior. which then gets captured by the CPI. So it becomes this self-referential loop, which is not how we have any other measures in the world. Can you imagine trying to build a house with the ruler, where once you reached a certain length, the units of measurement changed after that point. And then once you reached another measurement of length after that, the units of measurement changed again. You would never be able to make the first cut, because it would always seem to be different depending on what you're measuring. So yeah, it's a crazy proposition, but at the same time, these are the two numbers that we live our lives by in the economy, is GDP and CPI. But even still, if this is the lowest number that can possibly be gotten by manipulating the basket of goods and everything else, it's not looking very good. 8.5% is huge.
And I think, Preston Pish touches a lot on this, where he says the delta, or the difference between, the official CPI, you can say whether it's real or not, but the official CPI and the risk-free rate has never been this big, even it's since World War II. So, literally, if you want a risk-free return in the US, you're getting -6% currently if you hold your bonds to maturity. So it really does make you question what the value of some, the 60-40 composition of portfolios, 60 stock, 40 bonds. We're living through, as Simon Dixon says, some of the most extraordinary and exciting times of financial history. And, thank God for Bitcoin, really, because this is bizarre, where you've got the risk-free rate guarantees you a 6% loss.
It's crazy, isn't it? And look, I've got a side note here, which is Germany's producer price index jumped to 30.9% March year on year. And that is a leading indicator. So usually it means the CPI will catch up to that. And that's the highest level since 1949. I don't think we need to comment specifically on that. I think it's just another side note to know, this is where we are most likely going. This is where America is most likely going. So if it seems pretty dire now, a real return of -6% risk off in quotations, that's only going to become a runaway delta, isn't it?
Mm.
Interesting times indeed. Also catastrophic times, it feels like sometimes. And I'm just really glad for Bitcoin, because I feel like I'm walking around Zen most of the time, and I absorb this bad news and I think this is great. This gives me hope for the future for some strange reason, but it's only because Bitcoin is at the core of that.
It's because you're a psychopath.
Exactly right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again, Dale. That's a lot of news that we put out there. I did have another point here, which was just basically Bitcoin mining is decentralizing further. TSMC is setting up a new chip foundry in Arizona. I don't think that's huge news. It's just another bit of tech news. But was there any other points that you've seen come up recently, or any other final comments you want to make?
I think, really, really thorough. Really enjoy the conversation. Thanks for having me on. And I hope we can do it again sometime.
Absolutely. We sure will.
Yeah,
thanks,
I'm,
everyone.
I'm a chatty Cathy. So yeah, next time maybe I won't talk as much.
No, it's me too. No, you're you've done exactly what we had planned to. I think we just had a lot of news, so it's taken a bit longer than what I expected. So thank you very much for sharing your time. Thanks, cool. Everyone, for listening. And until next time, catch you then.